Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled.
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
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 I even joined in this time because I think we all genuinely like this film.
It is worth the applause.
Yeah. This week's film is Vampire's Kiss, and having a chat about it is me, Richard Nicholas, my other hosts, Jamie Thomas,
Hello.
Anthony Evans,
How do you do?
and Abigail Bain.
Hello.
So, gang, it's technically Abby's choice, but really, it's a film we've all took to heart, isn't it?
Yes, the slightest mention of this in our little discussions, and we were all just instantly on board. We all love this
Yeah.
film, right, guys?
We do. Absolutely.
Yeah. Abby, it is your choice, but I think Jamie's the one who introduced it to us all. We were all having a chat about Nick Cage or Nicolas Cage, but this is very much a Nick Cage movie, if Jamie's rules are to be
Hold
applied.
on, no, you've disobeyed the rules there.
Really?
This is Nicolas Cage because this is an actor's bizarre movie. Nick Cage is Con Air, The Rock, that kind of stuff.
Oh, right. I thought it was whenever Nick Cage is weird as heck.
No,
It's Nick. Okay, so.
whenever he's like an action hero or something like that, it's Nick Cage because
That
it
sounds
sounds
hard and
like,
manly.
yeah, whereas Nicolas Cage is the actor who does weird stuff.
And he does plenty of weird stuff in this one.
Yeah.
But I think we were talking about him, and we were all kind of fans because he's kind of weird. He's good in some films, weird in others, and sort of pedestrian and small. Like, he's got a mixed kind of back catalogue, but he's a very cult actor because people love him or hate him, don't they?
Yeah.
And we're fans, right, guys?
Oh, yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And Jamie went, "Have you guys seen Vampire's Kiss?" And like, it was several months, maybe more than a year ago, we were like, "No." Oh, and then he was like, "Well, guys, you should watch it because it is amazing." And then we all did. I think we might have looked up clips on the internet and gone, "This looks like the weirdest thing ever." And in fact, if you do look up, like, what was it like? There's like a compilation of this film that is just amazing.
Yeah, there's a compilation of YouTube of the best moments, which essentially is everything you need from the film.
It says a lot as well that it's the best moments from the film, but the whole clip compilation is Nick Cage. Like, barely anyone else features in that best scenes compilation, if anyone at all, in fact.
So it's kind of a cult classic film. I mean, it's nominally about Nick Cage being obsessed with vampires and spiraling into madness. But we should give the details as a courtesy at the top of the show. So, Abby, can you give a quick who made this list, please?
Yes, this week's film is Vampire's Kiss from 1988. It is directed by Robert Bierman, written by Joseph Minion, stars Nicolas Cage, Maria Conchita Alonso, and Jennifer Beals. And the gist goes thus. After an encounter with a neck biter, a publishing executive thinks that he's turning into a vampire.
Yep, that's it.
You know what I like about
Nutshell.
that? The vagueness of neck biter.
As opposed to a what other, like, I don't know,
Why doesn't he say
blood
vampire?
transfusion vampires? What are the different types of vampire? Oh, well, it'd be nice if we got bombarded with comments, but we wouldn't. But I don't want to have a long debate about what types of vampires there are. It's far too boring. Point is, he finds a vampire bat, and then a woman bites him, and that doesn't matter. We'll get into it. So, we all basically rewatched this after already finding it amusing and intriguing, and we're here to give it a bit of air some of our thoughts on it formally. So, how would you guys say Nicolas Cage performs as this character? What's his name?
Peter Lowe. It's
Peter
Lowe.
Lou.
It's an odd one because at the beginning it's quite he stands out, shall we say, because he's being quite weird. But yet, as the movie progresses, he just kind of melts into it and just fits perfectly with the weirdness of it all.
It's almost like, oh, he's doing a weird voice, sort of an impression or homage to Keanu Reeves in a sort of like American Psycho style yuppie character. And then it's kind of explicable once it's shown up to being this crazy loon. It's so weird. It's kind of pseudo bohemian surfery, but
Cage said that his character, the character of Peter Lowe, affects that voice to impress people. He tries to sound more educated. He is educated, but he tries to sound it and play it up.
He wants to sound like a yuppie, guy.
It's particularly apparent, actually, sort of in the middle bit of the film, I think, when he's in that boardroom with all the other yuppies, and they're talking about how he chased Alva into a bathroom, and how that's hilarious, apparently.
Yeah, and he does his fake laugh, which is not quite as good as he does it earlier in the film.
It's almost, at that point, at the start, when he's doing his fake laugh, it's like, oh my gosh, he's the worst actor in the world. It's possibly because he's mental and affecting an accent. And he can't genuinely laugh properly as a character, not as an actor.
I think, to talk about his performance in this film, because, like, without his performance, the way he does it... It would still be unique, because it's an odd story, but it would have...
Yeah.
I mean, not that it hasn't been forgotten, but it wouldn't have become the cult hit that it has become without... Mm. Cage just going full tilt at it. Like, he ran at it head first and then smashed into it because he had his eyes closed and was flailing his arms around. And, like, the reason I enjoy this film so much is because I don't understand what was going on in Cage's head when he came up with this performance. And I
don't know if he's a genius or the lunatic that he's portraying.
Yeah, or I don't know if, like, he read the script and thought, this just sounds stupid, and, like, pretended to everyone on the set that, oh, yeah, this is great, I'm really enjoying this, this is going to be this is going to be one of my top films that I've done. And then inside was like, I can't believe they're falling for this. And just, like, kept... at one point in the film, he cries and says boo-hoo 3 times.
Yes! I was going to bring that up, and how that is utterly mental on every level.
And it's like the counter to the laugh earlier, the ha 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 ha.
Yeah,
it's just, oh,
it's a tremendous performance, but it creates such a quotable movie. There's just an onslaught of amazing lines that are kind of... some of them sound like they're so bad, they're kind of the room quality, where it's just, you can't act and you're insane. But Nicolas Cage is perhaps portraying someone who's that weird. Like, they're that kind of badly delivered or weirdly put, or just strange things he does or says. It's the way he says it, it's how he says things, it's what he says, and they're all the way through. It's just so weird, isn't it? Everything he says and does.
I think, as well, in some ways, it's actually quite a brave performance in how weird it is, because this was like this is when he was starting to kind of break out. This was just after he'd done, or a couple of years after he'd done Raising Arizona, the Coen Brothers film, which again was a very kind of unique performance, but a lot more, it was over the top and cartoony, but it's more traditional.
Yeah.
And it was very good. And that he was just starting to make a name for himself. Then this came along and he gave this performance when he obviously knew he was starting to, his star was on the rise, and it was like he just didn't care. And he was thinking, I can't believe everyone's still falling for this.
He turns what is like essentially a sort of dramatic, slightly horror-y plot into a comedy just by being so weird.
That's the other thing.
It's probably the character written as well, but he's definitely adding an extra level to the weirdness of it with his performance.
The film seems to be considered a comedy, like, just generally, but I think it's only a comedy because of Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, because on paper, it is about a man tormenting one of his staff members in the publishing company, and it's also about a man having delusions of becoming a vampire.
Yeah.
So that doesn't necessarily have to read as comedy, does it?
It's a pretty dark story. It's a one man's kind of descent into madness, and he just becomes this pathetic shell of himself, then dies.
Yeah. And spoilers.
There's nothing particularly like uplifting about the story, and yet it's hilarious just because you're distracted by the fact that I can't believe this actor is doing it this way.
Yeah.
I think the best thing that sums that up is his relationship with Alva. It's just... You both dread and can't wait for the next scene to come with Alva, just because it's so wonderful what he's doing to her.
That's the other thing as well. There is nothing... From the very beginning to the very end, there is nothing sympathetic about Peter Lowe. He is, like, other than how crazy he is so unlikable. And he just gets worse as the film goes on. He's so horrible to Alva.
There's these moments where he starts to apologize and sound genuine. And you're kind of like, oh, he's being reasonable now. And he realizes he's been obnoxious. And then just as you think... You're going to get to the end where he's like, sorry, Alva, I was a fool and horrible to you, and let me make up for it. He turns instantly to this horrible, nasty, abusive man and ruins any sympathy he could have got by coming out of his lapse of sanity. I don't know.
He keeps doing it as well. That's every the thing. Yeah. Like, yeah, every single time.
He's literally the worst boss in the world.
That's one of the things about this movie. You're watching it, and each moment comes by, and you think, it can't get any better than this. But it just keeps coming. It's an anomaly. This film shouldn't exist. And yet there it is in all its glory.
I think... As far as the film, like, yeah, standing on its own and being an anomaly goes, the scene later on that does it, that when he has accepted that he's become a vampire, so he buys a set of plastic vampire teeth and puts them on his park.
You think he's utterly invested in the idea of him becoming a vampire? But he cheaps out on the teeth.
Yeah.
And there's something about that really tickles me. I'm not quite sure what it is.
It's just because I think the whole film is just kind of full of all those weird kind of artistic decisions by maybe the director and Cage himself, where I suppose you could explain it like, you know, at that point he's given away all his money and he doesn't really care what he looks like, and that's why he's got the plastic teeth. But there's still a set of plastic teeth. At the end, and it's just ridiculous.
It's the shot when he puts them in and looks up at the camera, and there's that sting of music, and he kind of works his jaw as if he's like, oh, it's just...
Like
it's
he's
just...
Nosferatu or something.
Yeah, and then he gets down on all fours and just crawls away.
He does. Once he buys the bag, he rushes out the shop. Yeah. And he opens it like a crackhead getting the crack and just tears into the bag and discards it and puts it in his mouth. And it's just the relief on his face that he has these awful teeth in.
And
that is like kind of a summing up of the whole thing, really, that whole bit.
I want to know as well, in that sequence when he finally, like, when he runs down the street shouting, I'm a vampire! I'm a vampire! And, like... the sequence where he's finally accepted that he's a vampire and he runs through the streets shouting it. And everything from then on that takes place in public, I want to know, did they film that at a distance and just let Nick Cage
freak out real people?
Yeah, like there's the bit where he's walking down the street after like everything's gone wrong and he's made himself a makeshift steak out of a pallet. And he's, like, loping down the street. He's covered in blood from someone he's murdered in a nightclub. And there's that shot of him trying to get people to stab him with the stake. Please, I'm a vampire. Kill me. And the people are looking at him like, you're out of your mind. And I want to know if he was in... some of those shots are him just doing that to people and they just filmed him from a distance, which...
If they're extras, they're doing a really good job of being naturalistic and not going to just get the attention of being in the film. Like, because they're very believable extras at every point, so to kudos either way, like to either coming up with filming it that way or the extras who are just really, really good at being believably real.
That's reminded me of something else as well that I don't want to. It's just popped into my head. I want to mention it before I forget it. When he encounters the cross outside the church when he's carrying his groceries home,
yeah,
and he drops them and falls to his knees in front of the church and shouts up the daughters of the damned.
when the bells happen, yeah.
Oh.
Any time he sees like sunlight or his reflection, he has a brilliant reaction.
Yeah. Touching the mirror.
Yeah.
And then later on when he's in the toilet and he gets a row from that man who's trying to do an obtuse in the bathroom. And he's just there going, "Where am I?" Because he can't see himself, but we can see him in the mirror.
That's the thing as well. The film doesn't even like pretend. It doesn't like they didn't get rid of his reflection and make it. No, he's right there. He's just going absolutely out of his mind.
And just the row he gets off that guy is tremendous. Yeah. Like, and it's so funny.
It's matched with like his hysterics as well. "Where am I? Where?" Like he properly plays it. Like he is completely hysterical.
I think, okay, we're just going to have to bring up bits we thought were brilliant and say what they were.
There's no other way to talk about it.
There's no way to talk about it. All it was is, initially, like, he's a regular sort of yuppie who works in a publisher's, and he's taking a woman to bed, and a bat comes in, and at first it's just a funny drunken situation. They're both drunk. He's scaring off the bat, and he's talking to his therapist about it. And that's the setup. And initially we think, he could actually be, like, there could be a vampire at this point. It could just be the woman he meets the next night is a vampire. But then after a while, it's obvious that he's just deluded, and you enjoy it for that, don't you?
That's the thing. The film presents it right then and there, because he brings this woman home, and they're, like, making out, and then it was revealed she has fangs, and she bites him and drinks his blood, and you think, oh, horror movie, vampire. Then the next day, he's shaving, and he cuts himself and puts a plaster over it. And then he makes coffee and he comes back in and he's talking as if she's there. And then he holds the coffee out over the bed to her and there's nobody there. And he just sits there holding the coffee out and then it fades out. The film has basically just said he's completely delusional.
Yeah.
And
it escalates.
Yeah. And then
up to the point where the bat comes into the room and the woman that he's with is freaking out.
Yeah,
that's the. You're only sure up until then. Anything that happens after that is on dodgy ground.
Well, it's either a vampire woman, or like there isn't. But it's very shortly after that. Like Jamie says, after he gives the cup of coffee to no one, we get clued in as a watcher. Oh, he's imagining this, and then it's not just he's imagining a life as a vampire. He just becomes insane and intolerable to everyone, apart from his bosses, who seem to get on with him.
Yeah, that's the other thing as well. No one really raises an alarm here.
He basically just tortures the one woman called Alva, and that's the movie, and him talking to his therapist and being he's just being insane all the time, the rest of the time. There's nothing much else to it, and it's built around this tension between him and his assistant Alva, who he keeps making look for a particular contract that someone in the building... Well, let's just talk about all the bits we like. There's no point talking around it anymore. We'll just take turns.
It has weaknesses as well. I mean, I mean, like, ones that actually stand out beyond when you actually try and look past Cage's performance. But his therapist...
is the worst therapist ever.
Well, not only that... The actress is Elizabeth Ashley, which sounds familiar, but I'm not sure what else I've seen her in. But in this, she's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like her performance is really like stilted, and I don't know if it's because she's playing against Cage as he is in this film.
Mm.
But
kind of not neutral enough as a therapist as well. She seems to be trying to be more sympathetic towards him and trying to help him, where she should just be letting him get out his, you know, thoughts or something. But then you think her performance is a little off, do you, Jamie? I'm not sure. I didn't think anything too strongly.
she's not terrible. I just didn't think, I didn't think she was very good in this. Like, she didn't see, she seemed like she was acting. She didn't seem, which is a weird thing to say, considering.
I'm trying to remember, yeah, she's in Dragnet. Is that the other thing you might have seen her in? It was the year before this. And so far as I can tell, that's just her acting style.
It's hard to pick up in this film because Cage's performance is so encompassing of the film. But yeah, no one is really giving any standout performances here.
Actually, I would disagree. I think Maria Alonso as Alva does a very good job of being genuinely sympathetic, partly because of how horrible Peter Lowe is to her.
But then how much of that is acting and how much is that her just reacting to Nicolas Cage?
Being genuinely afraid.
Yeah. What I liked with her family is her mother is like, everyone, like, she knows that Peter Lowe is insane and horrible to her. And her family, her mother and her brother are kind of, oh, you know, bosses are always horrible. You have to go to work and stuff. And it's like, no, no, if you'd been there, you'd know she legitimately shouldn't have to go into work. So I like that her family are normal and kind of don't, like, they don't really expect it to be as terrible as she's obviously getting. And she's quite nice. Every time she's kind of tortured by him, she's just about comes round to the idea of trying again and putting up with it, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's trying so hard to do what he asks. And
yeah,
he's just relentless.
It's insane.
Appearing at her house, soup! And then...
The relationship between those two characters is just insane. What do you guys think? Is it like... Do you think he's, like, attracted to her or something? And this is his weird kind of way of expressing that?
The first time I watched it, I thought that was the way it was going to go with him and Alva, that he's... There's a point in the film where he has this odd realization after he's encountered a taxi driver and who talks about his wife. And it starts to hint that Peter's problem, I maybe it's hinting all the way through the film and I just missed it, is that he's alone. Like, he's lonely and his life is completely hollow. And that it's as if he's having a realization that Alva is the person, she was right there the whole time. But the film is too completely mental to be that specific about anything. But instead he, like, almost rapes her in the parking garage before
the end of it,
I mean, that's when he has his I'm a vampire realization, because he tries to shoot himself with what he doesn't know with blanks, which again is another amazing investment in the performance by Cage to put a gun loaded with blanks in his mouth and pull the trigger twice.
Isn't that how Brandon Lee died?
It is dangerous to fire blanks, even though they're not bullets properly. Yeah,
especially into your own mouth.
They could have been like lesser, like Hollywood effect blanks, though. They could have been not as dangerous.
Yeah,
I mean, the man eats a bug for the performance.
I forgot about that as well. A live cockroach.
Yeah. There are times where you think, "Ooh, this has ideas about a one man's perception of, I guess, women," because the woman he's seeing on a drunken yuppie night out at the start of the film looks very similar to the woman he is delusionally imagining to be a vampire.
Yeah.
So maybe he has a type, and then Alva's different, but like, it could be that he has difficulty with women, but like you say, it doesn't really settle down long enough on those themes for you to know if it was attempting something.
If you were to think about it enough, I think if you really picked it apart, you could see, you know, he has a very shallow relationship with women, and then he's got this imaginary woman who he's completely in love with, and she's destroying him.
Mm.
And that's his, like, desperate loneliness that's somewhere inside him that's coming out. And I suppose that, you know, he watches clips of the original Nosferatu, and you know, that's the whole thing with Dracula, is that, you know, he's alone. He's cursed God because his wife died, and he's isolated. He's a hermit, and I guess that's maybe what the film is trying to go for. That's
Yeah, but it doesn't really try and answer why he's insane. It just, that's the main weak point, is it isn't a portrait of a kind of delusion and insanity. It doesn't really give you a reason why he would go insane. We kind of come in on him being pretty much weird from the get-go, and then become super weird.
It's all just full-on from the beginning. There's no gradual build-up which could like portray a more realistic kind of way that a mental person would work, to put it. But it's like I said, it's just full on at the beginning.
But it's not like American Psycho, where again it's full on from the beginning. He's already nuts, but it plays with how nuts he is and whether the murders are real and whether he's just completely delusional and making everything up and living in a fantasy. Yeah. It doesn't do that. It presents it right at the start. It says, look, this guy's nuts. Let's watch him go even more insane and then kill himself.
So, our favourite bits, Abby, moments of the film that you want to bring up so we can have a chat about, and we'll all have a go of thinking of our favourite bits, and hopefully we'll cover them all.
I think my favourite bit also has my least favourite component, I guess, of the movie. It's when he's talking to a wall and he thinks he's talking to his therapist. That's really good. But what I don't like about it is the absolutely terrible blood goatee he has after he's killed that woman. It just looks awful.
It does and have...
He's only transported there because he bumps into the wall. Like, if he hadn't and he kept going, he might not have had that weird therapy session in his head.
The whole lead up to that scene is so great as well, because that's the way he's walking around with the stake, going, I'm a vampire, kill me. And then, like, there's that shot of him just walking down the street going, oh, just wailing and dragging the stake with him. And then, he just bumps into the wall head first.
And it's such an oversized bit of palette as well, not even a steak-sized steak.
It does have the, which is... I don't even know how to describe that line reading of the word wow.
Also, because that seems so interesting, because he's had regular therapy sessions, at least we assume he has, where it's been like genuine therapy. And then in this one, he's talking to his therapist and he's standing in the window of her office and sort of... And suddenly she's being very agreeable to the things she says. And then it descends more into a sort of... like a fantasy of him, like of everything going well for him. Like by the end of the therapy session, she's introducing another client and telling him he's correct and that you'll love this woman. And they kind of, she brings in her next patient and they fall in love. And like, it's kind of like a man's fantasy of his day going perfectly suddenly. And then it keeps cutting to him in the street, covered in blood, going,
with himself. That does kind of sort of answer the question of why he's nuts, because it demonstrates very succinctly and very quickly his problems with women, because he meets this fantasy woman in his head, who he's again made up, and then has a perfect rapport with her until it takes him from the time he leaves the street corner to the time he gets home to fall out with his imaginary fantasy woman completely and kick her out of his flat.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. Well, he gets to the flat and they're literally screaming at the woman who isn't there. And then one of my favourite bits, he collapses to the floor and then shakes about and sort of slides under the couch that's upturned as his pretend coffin.
Oh, it's the wretch. And then...
He wretches himself into it. It's amazing. Amazing.
I really like the way that Nicolas Cage was too tall to be under that couch. So there was always some bit of him sticking out one end or the other.
He has an amazing go at he wrecks his apartment kind of in two phases, but it's amazing when he trashes his apartment. It looks so fun. I'd love to just rip everything off the walls and kick everything.
The childlike crying he does when he gets the note from the girl, stay out of my life, and he kind of tears it up, and then he does in the mirror the what is happening to me, but I can't even do it justice. When he holds on to the sink and what is happening to me? And then goes nuts and smacks his apartment to pieces.
Nicolas Cage has such fun with it. You could tell, like, he's enjoying all of the insanity. Anthony, do you want to bring up a bit that's a favourite of yours, if you've got one?
Oh, it's hard to choose. Just any of the scenes where he is tormenting Alva are just my favourites. Because I don't know, I just like how insane he is, how innocent and put upon she is, and just any scene with those two are my instant favourites. Although I do have another one. It's the alphabet scene.
Amazing.
Just all of that scene.
The fact that he goes through the whole alphabet to make his point.
And what's great is he's escalating in volume and anger about about how keeping things in a file system should be easy. And he just lists the alphabet. And he's doing loads of gestures and pointing and putting his hands on his hips for each syllable. And just going really crazy by the time he gets to Z.
Yeah.
And then the line that the psychiatrist has is amazing. And she just goes, "You really know your alphabet." Like, amazing. So good.
Oh, and the bit like that ends it where she's like, "Well, I don't know who would misfile it." Well, you're the worst psychiatrist ever then.
Yeah.
I never misfile anything. Not one time. It's like a child. So good. The Alva torture scenes are interesting as well because they build, and it's not like a conventional "I'm going to break your thumbs" torture. It's a psychological warfare of the workplace, and it's just this MacGuffin of finding this letter in loads of files that is missing, and it doesn't even matter to him by the end. He's like, at the end, he's literally too late.
Just,
that's amazing. Everyone wants to do a too late, don't they?
Yeah,
it's all too late.
Too late.
Too late. It's all too late, Alva. And
you reminded me of the bit before that, actually, where I want to give Nicolas Cage some a compliment for being able to jump on a desk so firmly and well when he's chasing her.
Well, it builds from the scene, doesn't it, where he's kind of crossed with her again, like, and he just starts off in his office saying her name, like, Alva.
But he says it so quietly.
Yeah, until he's shouting and everyone in the office could just hear him screaming her name until he comes out. And then, like, it is amazing the athleticism he has when he jumps on that desk, because he's a tall man, and he just jumps instantly onto the desk and points at her and goes, "There you are!" It's the most terrifying thing.
What do you guys
make of it?
He does it in front of everyone in the office.
And yet still, no one in that office brings up more than, "Oh, he's quite eccentric, isn't he?" No!
Yeah, it's like nobody's thinking, his behaviour has escalated recently.
It's because all the bosses are like, "Ha, ha, 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 we're clearly evil and have no sympathy for lower down poor workers. Ha, 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 I'm glad you were horrible to her." That's why. They're all horrible bosses.
I also like how easily he just kind of palms off his behaviour on drug taking and how people are just accepting of that. It's like, "Oh yeah, I did mess once, that's fine. I get it. Guess you're off the hook."
Bad.
I'm not really clear on how old Alva is supposed to be. Because the relationship she has with her mother in particular would suggest she's really quite young. But she doesn't look that young.
I presume she's meant to be in her like early 20s. From the background she's from, culturally it's more the norm for kids to still like live at home like into early adulthood, because her brother lives at home as well.
Yeah, and whenever she's like she's in terrible, like frumpy, old woman-y looking like clothes. But in the house, she seems a bit more casual and normal. Like, so maybe it's just for work she dresses a bit older than she is.
Did her shoulder pads make an impact on anyone else? Because they certainly did on me.
It's just the 80s, Jamie.
I know, but they were particularly big and pointy.
I think it was more her shoulder motifs in general for me. Because not only did she have the shoulder pads, she also had the weird sort of doilies that were built into the dress.
That's another part of Cage's performance as well that is great. The shoulders, the hunched shoulders that he develops as the film goes on and he gets worse.
Yeah, you can't fault his body language acting in this film. You can fault every other bit of his acting. Not that.
The hunched shoulders really come into play when he's gliding through the nightclub with his teeth in.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, channeling Nosferatu.
Yeah.
I suppose.
The scene I like when he's a little more sober and normal is he's trying to give Alva a row earlier on than some of his other stuff, but he basically says, look, this guy wants this contract, it's really important, and I want you to watch the loops I have to go through and the groveling I have to do to make it okay with this important client. And he has the most reasonable guy on the phone ever who's totally fine with it. And you think, oh yeah, now you, like, it's kind of revenge for Alva, but he still manages to turn it around and be like, you see, I couldn't get a word in edgeways. Yeah. He's clearly boiling mad, even though he's the most reasonable guy ever. You are in trouble now. Like, he just commits to it, and it's so funny. Oh. Are there other moments of torture we haven't mentioned for Alva?
I mean,
she literally goes around the house, doesn't she? I mean, it's insane.
The long rant about how she's the bottom of the rung as the camera slowly zooms in on Nicolas Cage's face and his unibrow and his big flaring nostrils as he tells us.
Like, his hair is kind of amazing because it's sort of a bit like, you know, it's curtains kind of, and it's sort of gelled back or whatever a bit, but it sticks out of the sides so much, but in a really smoothed out way. It's insane. But it's a tremendous rant off the back of him almost apologising to her as well.
Yeah, and then it becomes about how it's the worst job. What is it? I couldn't think of a worse job if I wanted to, and you have to do it, or I'll fire you.
That was a great impression. Definitely. Oh, yeah, I mean, they're all amazing. Is it like he's chasing her into the woman's toilet at one point? He literally runs her down where she's so frightened she's firing like the blanks in the gun at him.
That's the other thing as well, is part of his torture seems to be to get her to pull the gun on him.
Like, yeah, there is that point where he kind of mumbles, "Aren't you gonna kill me? Use your gun, Alva."
I think the only time in the film where he's remotely sympathetic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like he's actually wanting... He kind of wants to die now because he's, like, knows he's going crazy a bit, and he kind of needs that to happen, but it can't happen because he's got blanks. And, you know, you think she probably would kill him, like, by that point. But the scene that where he goes to her house and gets in a cab and turns up, when he realises she's hiding from him and has phoned in sick and goes to the house, and he's initially reasonable... And just the tension from the, like, you'd be freaked out if this had happened to you. You could feel her kind of pain, can't you?
That's the thing as well. Everything he does is, like, on the surface, it's like, over the top, and it's hilarious, especially the way he does it. But if you imagine yourself in her situation, and you had a boss who was literally doing the things he does in this film, you would be terrified of that person.
You'd be definitely, yeah.
Absolutely.
Afraid.
I think the only thing that I'm disappointed with in this film is that Alva isn't the one doing the final killing, because she's the one who deserved to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the end, it's her brother, isn't it, who she gets to kind of just do something about him because he's, you know, literally attacked her and violated her and stuff.
It's never made clear either, and there seems to be some debate about this when I look the film up, whether or not he actually rapes her in the...
Yeah, he sort of starts to, and then I don't think it's implied that he does either.
No.
I think he sort of does, and then
he
passes out.
To it.
During his, yeah, he does confess to it at the end, but it's, I suppose the way she's reacting to it, it must have been.
But she passes out, and it doesn't show anything. It just sort of, he sort of just goes a bit crazy and tries to kill himself. But it doesn't properly convey that he did, but like you said, he suggested he did already.
I think it's he comes close enough to really do some psychological damage anyway, you know, even if he doesn't. And then, yeah, that's why she tells her brother, and he goes around with he's got a lead pipe. And
tire like iron. One of those things, tire iron, yeah.
Yeah, tire iron, that's it. And then, yeah, there's the scene where he kills the girl in the nightclub, a scene that is quite shocking because I wasn't actually expecting it, when the brother's in the apartment, like, threatening him, and Peter picks up the stake and holds it over his chest, and the brother kind of looks at it and thinks, well, yeah, all right, and presses it down and stakes him through the heart.
It doesn't quite sell. Like, it doesn't quite look, that couldn't happen. You couldn't have just killed him with that massive stake. Like, I don't know if on paper it sounded more plausible, but I don't think it looked right in the film. It didn't look like, okay, that would just hurt him. That wouldn't...
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? Do you guys buy that death, or...?
Only because it was... Like, Jamie, I think you were trying to say that it was actually kind of... Because you weren't really expecting it, it was kind of catches you off guard, and it has a bit of an effect on you. So, and I suppose poetically, it's the only way this film could have ended.
Yeah.
It would have been nice if it had been Alva, just because she deserves it.
Yes.
But then she doesn't get, like, at least the brother, he can, you know, pretend, she won't go to jail, and he might, after the repercussions of this, if he gets found out. It's unlikely from the scenario, because the guy was mental. But it's good that she doesn't stop being innocent, I guess, as well. That's probably why they avoided that in the writing.
Yeah,
or whatever.
She's still... like, essentially the good person that she is.
Yeah. And it's just... Sorry, Ab, go on.
I was just going to say, about, you're not sure if you bought the death, but it's sort of... I'm trying to think how to put it. It's to do with if you think something is going to kill you, it could kill you, even if it wouldn't have killed you.
Like a placebo effect.
Yeah, you sort of, you buy into dying.
Plus... But there's always this idea that there's a doubt that it could be reality. He could be imagining it. I kind of... There could be a sequel where he wakes up the next day just covered in ketchup and he thinks he's been murdered, but he hasn't. Like, there's another film in this, I think. They reveal that it wasn't real.
Oh, this film could never be replicated.
See,
it could only
gonna...
ever be serendipitous that it's this brilliant. Like, you wouldn't make it this good.
It is the definition of lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
Oh. There's so many bits as well, like just him chasing a pigeon in the street and like eating it in his apartment. Just the little moments where he just touches his hair and stuff.
I think that was my favourite bit where he puts the pigeon in his thing, goes off, and then the next scene is just feathers everywhere and a burp in the background.
It's the realism of him stood there kind of half burping, half retching because he's just eaten a live pigeon.
Anthony.
Yes.
I thought it would be much harder to catch a pigeon. Did they have some artistic...
Dick Dastardly definitely has a hard
time. Those
were
very tame pigeons, I will say.
Well, they're city pigeons, aren't they? You know how, like, non-intimidated by people they normally are, so they probably weren't expecting what happened.
If Anthony, you could just get your dad on the line to clarify how hard it is to catch a pigeon, because he's not Dick Dastardly, he just keeps them. But it is legitimately hard to catch them, because they have a special eyesight thing, don't they?
Oh yeah, they'd fly away. Simple as.
But for fair play, Nick Cage somehow got one, or, you know, his character did. Other bits, there was probably a few earlier on that are like just weird little moments. Has anyone got any others we might have missed, or have we covered the main strokes? It's worth seeing. Like, there's no getting around, it's got to be watched.
The thing he does every now and again after he's been bitten, where he suddenly holds the bite and, like, gnashes his teeth, and I'm not really sure what is happening to it. Like, is he getting the urge to bite? What's going on?
Ooh.
Yeah, he's weird. Ooh.
Sorry, I just remembered another odd moment where he just comes storming out of a cafe and then all of a sudden he's grabbing his neck like he's in pain.
Yeah.
And then someone tries to help him and he just runs away. Just a really odd scene.
And the cockroach eating.
Ugh.
Can't, like, not talk of it. It took 3 takes, apparently.
Oh, right. It looks hard enough to grab.
Yeah, it was really good hand acting, actually. I love the way that they pick up the, I'm not sure what you call that thing over a gas hob. Like, the metal thing that you actually rest the pan on.
Oh, like the grate thing.
Yeah, the way they picked that up and put it to the side, I really liked
it. Oh, it's just that they managed to get, as well, the most disgusting type of cockroach. You know, the longest legs and the biggest antenna they could find.
Yeah.
And, they go, eat that.
He'd certainly have a breeze if he ever went on one of those celebrity I'm in a jungle, torture me with various horrible foods programs, wouldn't he?
It's such a dedication to a role to eat a live cockroach on camera, and he really looks disgusted as well when he does it.
Ah, just all of the time as well. Like, there's little odd things in it as well. Like, outside his apartment one time, there's these weird mime couple.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
What is that? They're repeating the same little narrative where one of them slaps and like slaps one and the other one ducks. And it's like, I'm not even sure if one of them's a man dressed as a woman mime or not, but it's just in there as a bit of directorial flair or something.
We also, there's also a David Hyde Pierce bit part as well at the bar.
Was that him? Because it was so quick. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, it was him talking to somebody.
Oh, okay. There's a lot of interaction in clubs and stuff. You get a little sense of the 1988 club scene a bit. He seems to frequent loud, like, dance parties and things to find people. I guess because his weirdness doesn't get spotted. But it is the way, but by the end, the way he's going in and being like a full-on Nosferatu vampire. And no one's really bothered. The pedestrians are never bothered by him.
I know, and the shot when he comes up to the girl and she's like sat there by herself doing coke at one of the tables, and he like introduces himself and invites himself to sit with the gesture, and she just kind of laughs at him and does it back to him.
Yeah.
Like, no idea that she's about to die because of this psycho.
There's a thing about New York in particular where as soon as New York is in the film is a little bit about New York.
Yeah.
Because I wonder if people don't take that much notice of him some of the time. Because New York has this reputation for nutters.
Yeah, everything I've ever heard about New York suggests that he could get away with a lot of that.
They just shrug off crazies in the streets every day. It's just part of the furniture. Every now and again, because you said it's about a kind of portrait of New York, like all films set in New York are. But there's these long shots of Manhattan occasionally that are filmed quite nicely, and they have quite beautiful shots, and the music sort of swells up, and it's almost like just a normal story about a life in New York. And it tries occasionally just to pull away and say, hey, this is just a Manhattan story, you know? Like, it's just your movie. No, you're not.
I think what they were, how I interpreted that was that they were trying to show that outside of his little insane world, real life is still happening.
Yeah.
Like, he exists in some kind of normality, and he's just out of his mind.
He even pulls in, like, from time to time, things that have nothing to do with vampires. Like, he has that moment in the cab where he's, you know, Alva's gone off to get protection from her brother, and he's waiting for her going crazy, like, swearing about her and being weird and looking a bit ill and retching. And then the cabbie just talks to him as if it's normal that a guy's been shouting in the back of his cab this long. But he talks to him, and then that guy points out a picture of him and his wife. And then later on, Nick Cage is having a chat with him and his wife in his house, even though they're not there.
It's in his office. He hallucinates them on the sofa.
And they just put in those extra bits of madness that aren't vampire-themed as well, to really go crazy with it.
I think that's another suggestion that the reason he is the way he is because he's become so, like, cripplingly lonely. Because he doesn't have any friends, either.
So maybe there is this... Maybe there definitely is this relationship problem that causes it, but it's never explicit. It's just hinted upon.
And I can't work out if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I can't work out if they were so excited about just this guy's descent into madness that they didn't give him much depth, or if it's quite brave to just rely on what you're seeing right in front of you and just let the performance speak for itself. But then, you know, it's this performance. So, like, you can't get any kind of, like, grounded human character arc from it, because it's just, it's very similar to Jack Nicholson in The Shining.
But that doesn't go crazy until the end. Like,
no, but that's,
Nicolas
no, but,
Cage, every line is said in a tremendously weird and funny way.
That's the only problem I have with The Shining. It's one of my favourite films, but there's no descent into madness for Jack Nicholson. He seems dangerous right from the beginning, and then he just gets more dangerous as it goes on. And this is kind of similar, because Cage just is weird from the start, and then just gets weirder as the film goes on.
Yeah, because it's the circumstances in The Shining that get weird. I mean, the kid is the initial focus of that, and it sort of changes up to being about the weirdness of the hotel. Yeah. But this is just an exercise in weird things to say. Like, it honestly is just a big montage of surreal madness. Not surreal madness. It's a big montage of just one guy being weird and bullying people and being a vampire, pretend.
It is one of those rare films that you know, you say, like, people either love something or they hate something. And a lot of people do, like, hate this film. They think it's awful. And a lot of people love it. And I can understand both viewpoints perfectly. Absolutely. Like, I can watch it in a different mindset and think, this is awful. Like, it's this is just absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
Or I can watch it and enjoy every second of it.
Yeah. It's got that, like, so bad it's good quality. But I don't... It's directed by a guy who's seemingly quite a reasonable director. I think he went on to do stuff. He's done, like, The Bill and Holby City, the guy who directed it. So he's a very workman director. It's kind of bizarre that his film is so odd.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's pretty competent. Like, it's well enough put together. The only part that looks bad is the fake bat at the beginning, which does look atrocious. But, like, everything else is shot well enough, and there are a lot of, like, good looking shots as well. The inside of, after he's killed, the shot of the inside of his apartment with the light coming through the gaps in what he's put over the windows to block out the sunlight, and there's a lot of subtle stuff in there. I don't know how much of that comes from Cage about, like, the sunglasses and his, like, gradually worsening posture and all that kind of stuff, and all the nice montages of the city as well. I think
that's just the thing about this, where because there is a sort of baseline of general quality,
yeah,
you really enjoy it, even though it's being insane and completely unbelievable.
Yeah, because it's not like rubbish. Like, it's not amateur. It's not like Birdemic or The Room or some of these really, it's amazing how bad you did this. It's done well, but it's such a, like, odd, terrible performance and brilliant performance. It's compelling.
The whole film is like that performance. You don't know whether you think it's awful or whether you think it's absolutely genius.
Yeah.
And it is, because of that, because it's competently made in every other way, and because the performance is so insane, it's not forgettably bad, which works in its favour then, because even if you hate every minute of it, it would stick with you. Like, you would remember, like, if you hated it, you would go back and you would watch that compilation of clips of Nicolas Cage from this film.
Just to show people how bad it was.
Yeah, and then people would go out and watch the film because they wouldn't believe it was real.
Which is what we did.
It's weird because there's such a tremendous power to it. It's just inexplicable.
Yeah. And there's loads of Nick Cage movies, or Nicolas Cage, whoever you want to call him, where he has moments of madness. There's a long catalogue of brilliant bits in serious movies and bad movies where he's tremendously weird in them. But this one, from beginning to end, is him being weird, and that's all you get. The other films, you have to put up with maybe a bad performance from someone else, maybe a more serious film than he deserves to be in. Like, there's other films with him in, but this is the purest, weirdest Nick Cage film ever.
It's like peak Cage.
Are there any other points we need to bring up? Because I think we've pretty much said what our thoughts on it. Feel free to get any quotes out that you might have missed.
One of the things I don't, as enjoyable as his performance in this is, I think there's some kind of magic involved that his career survived after this film, he became the huge star he became after this.
Well, he is the son of a rather successful director, so...
Well, all right, okay. But it's all the same, like...
If he didn't have those connections, Nicolas Cage would be lost to us long ago. I'm so happy he does. I'm never a fan of nepotism, but it was right. It was right in this case.
Yeah. It was a gift to the world. Yeah. There's so much to say about this film, and yet it leaves you speechless immediately afterwards.
It's amazing. And you'll just find yourself quoting it throughout the week. I know we've been quoting it a bit today, haven't we, Ab?
Yes.
It is.
You can't help it.
I think it probably is the most quotable film I have ever seen.
Yeah, and it's just, like, watching it again, you find other little bits. Like, watching it this time round, I was like, oh, I didn't notice this guy. And I didn't, like, there's little things every now and again. I didn't even remember the pigeon thing. I don't know why. the fact that the bit in the cafe where he's like just waiting for his order has nothing to do with the plot of the film, but he just gets annoyed in the cafe that he's not getting served, and the guy who approaches him when he's being weird comes too early. He's almost consoling him before he's being weird.
You're right. So
it's just full of bits like that. Oh, I don't know, man. What's left to say? Anything at all?
Just watch it and enjoy.
Anyone who has, that's the other thing. I don't know who to recommend this film to. I want to recommend it to people, but I can only recommend it to myself. Like, it's because it's so odd that I would imagine it would stop people speaking to me if they watched it on their recommendation.
I know, it's one of those things where you sort of have to. You have to know someone really well before you can go watch Vampire's Kiss.
And I would never want to watch it with them unless it's very specific people.
Yeah. I think it's one of those films where I believe the first time we watched it, we probably paused like 100 times. After each bit, we'd be like, what's that? And we'd play, and then another thing would happen. That would be, all right, we have to pause again. What is going on? I mean, I don't think we need a rating system for this because, I mean, what could we say? What vampire is it? No. What insane person is it? It's just...
It can't be rated.
No.
It will not fall into any category.
No, and you can't even legitimately, like, down the middle, call it good or bad.
No.
Like, not even in a, like, objective opinion kind of way, because I don't know. I really don't know.
It's kind of like the American Psycho of vampire comedy, if that's a thing. Like, it's not any one thing, but it's a really interesting Nick Cage film. I think, generally speaking, you have to kind of know you have to, like, have enjoyed films a lot. You can't just be a casual film watcher and watch it, because you just go, well, that was stupid. No, you don't get the joke then. This is amazing. This is going against all the rules of cinema and inventing some new ones of its own. And it's just, you have to kind of know about regular performances and stuff before you can appreciate how amazing this is.
The other thing as well that didn't occur to me before is this film is such an anomaly. I can't imagine it, like, it doesn't seem to have influenced anything. Like, it's not one of those cult films like Evil Dead or Evil Dead 2 where, like, its influence is felt then, like, decades on through, like, you know, film nerds growing up and making their own films and...
Yeah, nobody ever says, oh, yeah, I watched Vampire's Kiss and then I wanted to do this. No one has ever said that.
Cage might have been cast in films because someone had seen this and thought, we need someone really weird. But, yeah, I don't, like, it exists purely by itself.
It is weird. It is like, it's kind of so bad it's good, but so good at being bad it's better than all of the so bad it's good films. It's the pinnacle of bad movies.
Yeah,
and it's definitely... not even at the bottom of all good movies. It's, I mean, it's just unbelievable. Like, so weird. Just weird. That's it. That's all I can say. Any final thoughts for the podcast, guys? Any goodbye? Or are we just literally just goodbye?
I sort of do still want to have a rating system because it's a tradition. But you are right that it's really weird and you don't know what to say. I think in this movie is the most weird looking exotic bird that you've ever seen or can think of, but in a really basic, plain-looking cage.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because there's something about the film that is just basically utilitarian and well-made. But it's just got this bizarre, mad thing in the middle of it.
It is. It's not so bad it's good because it was done shoddily and thrown together on a cheap budget by people who can't, like, who don't get how to do things professionally. Made by professionals, but somehow inside it is something that goes beyond professional and unprofessional. It's just weird performance madness. I don't know. It is kind of a pedestrian cage with the weirdest animal you've ever seen inside. and it's just a normal guy owns it, and he doesn't realise how special it is. And he's just like, oh, that's just my bird. It's the most tropical and beautiful bird I've ever seen. It's a complete new species. What is it? Oh, it's just Vampire's Kiss, the movie.
It's the boohoo bird. That it's called boohoo. Every time it opens its beak.
And it could just spew the catchphrases all the time, like, just, there you are! It just says Alva, and you just feel it back as it goes.
In the middle of the night, you could just hear the bird, Alva! Alva!
I think we have just identified that in this film, Nicolas Cage is impersonating a parrot.
It's just learnt weird things to say, and it makes no sense. Oh, well, yeah, I guess that well, everyone agreed it is basically this mad bird we've created.
I can't come up with anything. I really can't.
Yeah, I'm impressed, Abby, you even got that far. Well done.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And on that note, we should end the podcast. So we wish you, we give you a vampire's kiss goodbye. Mwah.
It never just goes away.
That was perfect.
Oh.